Welcome back to Stack Trace, the podcast where we talk about Apple news and rumors from developers' perspective. My name is John Sandell.
And I'm Guy Rambo.
What a week, huh? We had WWDC, so many cool new announcements, and it seemed to be a really great week there in San Jose. I think we were both feeling like next year we really need to be there, right?
Yeah, first of all, I envy everyone that was there because, it sounded like it was a ton of fun for everyone who was there and so many cool people there.
Yeah, absolutely. It's, you know, the thing about WWDC, it's not so much about the content of the actual conference, like the sessions and the announcements. It's so much more about all the events that happen around it. And I was last there in 2014, which was arguably a really great year to be there because Swift was announced. So there was like a lot of new cool things happening. But it's really like the memories that I have and the kind of things that I think about all the time is all the kind of cool things that happened, like all the parties and all the people I met and all the events around it. So yeah, next year I definitely want to be there for that.
Yeah, when people talk about conferences, they usually mention the networking side of it, which is you meet people. And for me, at least, I'm not a very social person, believe it or not. And when I used to go to conferences a while ago, I would usually just stay by myself and only talk to people if they came to talk to me. But more recently, I made many friends and I go to conferences sometimes, mostly to speak. And there are some friends that I only meet when I go to those conferences. So you have your conferencing friends.
Yeah, totally.
And me and you, you talk to me about your experience talking at conferences, and it sounds like you don't have to go to people because people come to you, right?
Yeah, it's definitely been like that recently, like in the past year or so. But it wasn't like that in the beginning. In the beginning, it was more like, you know, I had to make the effort to, you know, to talk to people and to, you know, walk around and joining with conversations and things like that. And I still do. Like, I like to mingle around a little bit whenever I'm at conferences. It's easy to kind of get stuck with the same group of people that you might know from before. And I love to just meet new developers and, you know, talk to them and hear kind of how they are solving problems. And I usually say that if I go to a conference to give a talk, even though I might be sharing some knowledge and, you know, sharing my experiences, the kind of end result that I leave with is that I gain so much more knowledge and so much more kind of experiences from other people than I actually brought with me there. So even though I'm speaking and a lot of people ask me questions and things like that, I always learn so much just from talking to other developers.
Yeah, you see, for me, coming up to a stranger and talking to them, starting a conversation, is very hard. So I'm going to leave this here. If we go to WWDC next year and you see me, please come talk to me because I'm not going to go and talk to you. So start, get the conversation going. After the first two phrases, I'm okay. But starting a conversation is very hard for me.
Yeah, I hear that from a lot of people. You know, a lot of people who might not be super kind of, what would you say? Like, they're a little bit more introvert maybe, or they're a little bit, you know, they might not be this kind of person who loves to like strike up a new conversation with a stranger. And that's totally understandable. What kind of helps me whenever I'm in this kind of situation is that I always think about that everyone is kind of here for the same reason, and everyone is here to talk to other developers. Everyone is here to learn new things. So that kind of helps me reduce the amount of stress that is normally associated both with giving a talk and also like just going up to someone that you don't know and, you know, strike up a conversation.
Okay, this was the first episode of Conferencing Therapy with John Sandell.
Exactly. All right, so we should start with some follow-up. So on the last episode, we played our first game of WWDC poker. Yeah. And first of all, it was so awesome to hear all the feedback from this episode. People seem to really like it. And, you know, thanks so much to everyone who kind of reached out or, you know, gave us feedback on this episode. That was really, really awesome. And it seems like you liked it. So we'll see next time Apple has some form of event, we might do something similar.
Yeah, I had fun doing it, and people suggested some changes that we may adopt for the next edition. So yeah, let's do it again. And I'm curious. I shouldn't pretend that I'm curious because I already know the results.
I know why you're curious.
Yeah, but please, John, tell us who won and how did we score?
Yeah, for sure. So we actually already revealed our results to our really good friends who joined our after show. So our after show is our special kind of Patreon live show where we get on a hangout, like on a video call, and just chat with the patrons who are supporting us with $5 or more per month. And we did our first after show during the week of WWDC, kind of giving our initial reactions and giving the result of the poker game, which was a lot of fun. So thanks so much to everyone who joined that. And if you want to become our Patreon as well, which will help us get closer to being able to do the show every single week, which we really want to do, and also join in on these after shows, which we're going to continue doing every single month, you can just head to our Patreon page at patreon.com/stacktracepod. So yeah, this poker game, it was exciting for me to kind of calculate the results, but as we're going to see, things turned out a little bit more grim for me than I thought. So we're going to start from the top. Our first bet was that we thought there was going to be more options for Do Not Disturb, and There was a ton of new features revealed during the conference or during the keynote about Do Not Disturb. There's now the option to turn on Do Not Disturb for a specific location or turn it off when you leave a meeting. And there's all kinds of features baked in. So we scored that point, both of us. So Guy, what do you think about these new Do Not Disturb features?
Yeah, I think they're great. I love the new Do Not Disturb in bedtime modes. It even has a little complication when you wake up. I'm going to call it a complication. It shows you the weather, and it's really nice. Yeah, I love those new features. And the option to disable Do Not Disturb when you leave your current location is also very nice.
Yeah, it's very smart. It makes iOS feel more like intelligent system where you can give it more just natural commands like, yeah, don't disturb me until I'm done with this meeting.
You know something that's really cool that they talked about? I'm not sure they mentioned during the keynote, but I watched a session on Passkit and Apple Pay, and mm-hmm. they mentioned that they have some new tags for passes on wallet. And if your pass is an event with a specific duration, like movie or something like that, a play, you can set the duration and you can suggest that Do Not Disturb should be enabled during the event. So
wow, that's awesome.
Yeah, so your pass, your ticket automatically enables Do Not Disturb for the duration of the event. I think that's very nice.
Yeah, because that's really where I feel like that's like where we can make like the next big jump in terms of user experience. It's not so much in like new cooler animations or these kind of big features. It's more like the way things integrate with each other. And if your pass can be aware of the time and then Do Not Disturb can be aware of that pass, then that's perfect, right? That like creates more this integrated experience that, you know, automates so many more tasks that we currently have to do manually. Speaking of automation, our next bet was that there was going to be a workflow kit or some form of developer tool to integrate with some form of new automation system and workflows. And this was kind of a wild card bet kind of by me, and you joined in as well. And it turned out to happen, which I'm really excited about. It's not called Workflows, it's called Siri Shortcuts, and there's a new Shortcuts app as well, which we'll talk a little bit more about later during the show. But what was your kind of initial reaction to this announcement? Were you actually expecting this to happen, or was it more like a wild bet from you as well?
No, we totally, it was a complete wild bet from both of us, and there were no rumors that I can recall mentioning something about workflow. So yeah, I'm very happy, and we're going to talk about it a little bit more later. But it's funny that there's even a framework now called Workflow Kit. It's not
yeah,
public,
exactly.
but it is called Workflow Kit. It came from the Workflow app, and now it's part of the system. So yeah, that's very cool, and I think we made a nice bet there.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing we really based it on was like there was a certain period of time since the Workflow app was acquired. So, you know, something has been brewing for sure. And I'm really, really happy to see that they actually took this product and brought it in-house and made it into a system framework like Workflow Kit, even though it's currently private, but exposing that as part of Siri. I think that was like a really, really awesome move. And I love the fact that it seems like the people who are working at Workflow, they are now doing kind of the same thing, but integrated into iOS. They're not just working on something completely different, which is always awesome to see whenever there's an acquisition like this, that the product kind of lives on, which is really cool. So next up was one of your kind of pet bets, and that is about iBooks. We were talking about it during the March event kind of analysis and around that. That we thought that Apple was going to rename iBooks into Apple Books and that they would have a new design. So that happened.
Yeah. I think it wasn't such a huge bet because we basically knew about it since January. So yeah, I'm happy that they did it.
Yeah, me too. It's really nice to see that Apple is unifying a lot of their storefronts to have the same design, because I really like this design. And I think like, yeah, bringing other stores to look kind of similar and to have the same discovery and the same nice style, I think it's a really, really good thing. One thing that didn't happen, though, is that there was no new continuous integration service from Apple based on BuddyBuild. And I guess this is a little bit too early. This was another kind of risky bet on our part. But it's too bad. I would love to see that happening maybe next year. But so far, no Apple CI service.
Yeah, maybe next year they're going to do something integrated, maybe with Test Flight or something. Let's see.
Yeah, something like that. One thing that was kind of sure to happen was that we got new Animoji characters. You know, no one was kind of doubting that with the big success that Animoji seems to be.
Not only that, but now we can make our own characters. And the quality of the tracking is amazing, especially for the eyes. And my Memoji did the opening for our after show.
Yeah, exactly. That was a really fun intro. You know, people were like, where is Rambo? Oh, there he is in a cartoon form or emoji yeah. form. Yeah, I mean, the rendering of the Memojis is really impressive. Like the lighting and the kind of shaders that they've built for those look really, really nice. It looks like a really high quality, like almost like cell shading. It looks very, very nice.
It's like having a Pixar studio in your pocket.
Yeah, exactly. It looks super nice. And also, of course, the new tracking seems to be really, really improved. Like if you use the current version of Animoji, it kind of always lags behind a little bit when you're talking fast. But now it seems to do the tracking like not one-to-one, but getting really, really close.
Yeah, the eyes are very impressive.
Yeah, absolutely. And the tongue, don't forget about the tongue.
Yeah.
All right, next up we had ARKit 2.0, another kind of pretty sure bet that given the focus that Apple is putting on AR right now, that we would see a new version of ARKit. I am pretty intrigued by the features that they chose to focus on for this release. Like they've chosen to focus on making AR more like something you can persist and share. So you have these AR worlds or scenes now that you can actually save, and you can also have multiplayer sessions or share them with other people, and everyone kind of sees the same AR scene from a different viewpoint, which I think can potentially take AR to some really cool new situations.
Yeah, with AR, I'm waiting for the glasses. I think when we have the glasses, if they are comfortable to wear and are not like Google's glasses, which failed, right. I think that's going to change things a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to do like a more focused episode on AR at some point soon, because I think we have a lot to say about it. Like, you know, how it could potentially impact us as developers in the long term, and form factors, and, you know, how would it relate to things like Microsoft's HoloLens. So yeah, let's save that for a later episode, shall we?
Yeah, definitely.
Awesome. But that's another one that we both got. And the next one was something that I know you are extremely, extremely excited about. We were texting a little bit back and forth during the event. And when they were building up to Mojave, and, you know, you saw the dark background and stuff, you know, you got really, really excited. So on a scale of 1 to 10, how excited are you about dark mode in
11.
macOS?
Yeah, so... there are two aspects to this. First of all, I really wanted to have it. And second, I had seen it before in the WebKit code and people didn't want to believe me, but I was right.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those things when now that we see it, it really, really makes sense. And, you know, like we also talked about on a previous episode when you did this discovery, is that it makes a ton of sense when you're working in an environment where you're mostly using these pro apps that have a dark UI anyway. It kind of becomes very jarring to switch to something that has a light background.
Yeah, and pro apps and apps that you use to consume media, such as video, they can benefit a lot from dark mode.
The next thing was that we predicted that we would have more fully featured watchOS apps using UIKit. And while we did get UIKit on macOS, we didn't get UIKit on watchOS, which I think was pretty interesting that the Mac got UIKit support before the watch.
Yeah, the watch already has UIKit, but it's not available to developers.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I think it's very interesting, but I really thought we wouldn't see significant changes to watchOS and tvOS this year, so that's why I bet against it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I bet for it, mostly as a kind of, you know, hopeful bet. Unfortunately, it didn't happen. There was some new cool changes in watchOS that we'll talk about a little bit later. But unfortunately, we still have to use WatchKit. So yeah, we still have to use all the, you know, WatchKit elements, user interface elements and things like that. We can't build these more sophisticated UIs yet, but hopefully that'll come soon. One thing that did happen was that there was a mention on stage about iOS being kind of all about improving under the hood systems, like making changes to performance and stability and things like that. And that's the one that you called, which I think was really nice.
Yeah, when Craig said we're doubling down on performance, I screamed because
hooray!
Yeah, I thought, well, I think that qualifies for what I said. And basically we came to agree that it had to be a key point in the presentation, and I definitely think we can say it was.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was definitely a theme throughout the whole conference, I would say. There were so many sessions about performance and fluidity, and really kind of both showing the work that Apple has been doing to improve kind of all the frameworks and this operating system and all the under the hood things, but also really encouraging both developers and designers to start thinking about, you know, fluidity, performance, you know, removing bottlenecks and things like that.
Yeah, I love it when they use their own experiences as examples during sessions. The one I was just watching before we started recording was about adding the light to your iOS apps. And initially I thought it was something about design, but I was totally wrong because they mentioned supporting external displays and NS user activity and launch time, scrolling performance. And they used the screenshot UI on iOS as an example of how they used it to debug some issues they were having, and showing the screenshot UI process in the Xcode debugger and stuff. And I think that's really cool when they use real-world Apple examples. There was another one where they used Xcode itself as an example. So yeah, oh, yeah. I really liked those sessions.
Yeah, I mean, it's always so nice when Apple is dogfooding some of their own technologies and tools. And I think the more and more further we go, like the more and more sophisticated the third-party tooling that we have, like the SDK becomes, the more powerful it becomes, the more Apple is also dogfooding. I would guess that in the beginning, like in iOS, you know, 1 or 2 or 3, most of Apple's apps were using a lot of internal tools that wasn't exposed to us. But it seems now that more and more they're using the same tools as we are, which I think is really, really good, because that also brings a whole new level of quality to the APIs themselves.
Yeah, and I think I feel like this is something that changed at Apple. I don't know exactly when, but they used to not dog food stuff so much as they do today. So when they release a new API, I've been spelunking their systems for a while, and you can definitely see that they are actually using the stuff they introduced in their apps. So, and that makes a huge difference for the quality of the APIs we get.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Next up, we have a bunch of hardware-related bets, which didn't happen because, as they said in the beginning of the keynote, it was all about software, which most WWDCs have been all about software. So it wasn't super surprising. But again, we like to throw in a couple of bets there about hardware as well. So we were thinking there might be a new iPad Pro, there might be a new MacBook Pro, but none of those happened. Also, we did not see a new version of Swift Playgrounds on iPad, at least not in the keynote. There is some new changes to Swift Playgrounds. There's some new subscription things that you can take advantage of and things like that, but nothing in the keynote. We also did not see a single sign-on solution that we also were betting on. And finally, also related to hardware, still no sign of AirPower. Did Apple forget this product was announced?
Yeah, it's getting interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like they must have run into some kind of difficulties when it comes to either like production or just finalizing the software or something like that, because it's really, really delayed. We can definitely say that we're not in the beginning of 2018 anymore.
Yeah, I'm feeling that it's probably coming either in September with the new iPhones or just next year, really.
Yeah, probably. One thing that we did see, though, was a new feature focusing on digital health. Apple calls this Screen Time, which is a new feature that shows you kind of a dashboard of how you're using your phone and also enables you to set limits both for yourself and for your kids for like how long they can play games or use certain apps and things like that. And we also talked about that, actually, that we would like to see that with increased parental controls. So I think that was pretty spot on. What do you think, Rambo?
Yeah, that was spot on. And I think they even mentioned the term digital health at one point. So yeah, that was really cool. And you mentioned that maybe they could add it to the health app. And then I said that maybe it would be something in settings. And turns out it is something in settings. So yeah, we got that one.
Yeah, we totally did. And we're going to dive a little bit more deeper into that in just a second. But we have a couple of more bets. We had CoreML 2.0. That was another one of those, you know, that's pretty likely to happen. So we saw that. We did not see really on-device machine learning, not for iOS yet, but we did see a much easier to use learning tool for training models in Swift Playgrounds, which I thought was a really neat solution, like how they implemented a live view in a macOS playground, and then you can drop things in there and they can use that as the UI for actually training machine learning models. I thought that was like a really clever solution.
Yeah, maybe they didn't have time to implement that in the Xcode UI, so they just let's release just do the playground. It as a playground. Yeah,
but it is like really cool. I love to see that, and I got a lot of ideas of how you could build more easily. You could build more like visual scripts. Like if you want to be able to drag and drop things in, let's say you want to automate some tasks, you could actually use playgrounds for that. You could use the live view without having to build a whole Mac app. You could just, you know, have a UI where you accept a drop, and then you could perform work on that in the playground. So I thought that was a really nice solution.
Yeah, I like it.
Again, we didn't see any hardware, so no new iPhone SE. And but we did get a new version of the Mac App Store. Now, that was another one of those finally kind of moments that we sometimes get, because the Mac App Store has been seemingly abandoned for so long, and now we have like a brand new version. It looks great. Apparently, it's a native Mac app, so no more web UI, which I think everyone is very happy about. I can guess that you are in particular like this direction.
Yeah. And we can't talk about the new Mac App Store without mentioning the Scream.
This year, we are turning our attention to the Mac App Store.
That was an epic scream.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, yeah. So many emotions when it comes to the Mac App Store, isn't there?
Yeah, like I think if I was there, I was going to do that scream because I've been waiting for a new Mac App Store for at least 4 years now.
Yeah, exactly. It's been in the same state for so long. And, you know, for the last few years, I've even been using like a command line tool called MAS, which just lets you run kind of all the installation things that the Mac App Store uses under the hood, like the service that it communicates with. It just calls that from the command line, so you don't have to open the Mac App Store.
Yeah, I've been using that as well by your recommendation, the MAS command line tool, and I use the software update command to do software updates, so I basically never opened the Mac App Store.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that's a pretty bad review of an app when it's like you will go through all those extra lengths and jump through all those hoops to actually just avoid opening the app, right?
Oh,
so,
yeah.
So, yeah, I'm very happy about this. It looks great, and there's also some new companies coming back, which we're going to talk about later. So, yeah, thumbs up on the new Mac App Store. We did not see a merging of the iOS and the Mac App Stores, so that's maybe, you know, that's something that we might see next year, especially now that Apple seems to be moving a lot of their developer tools to be more unified, especially with Marzipan and things like that. So, yeah, maybe next year. And finally, we did not see third-party watch faces. So this might soon turn into something that we feel is never going to happen, but one can hope, right?
Oh, yeah. So, the results.
The results. All right. So, Guy, you accumulated total of 28 points. So, the way we calculated this was that if we won the bet, then we got the points. And if we lost the bet, we lost those points. So, 28 points for you. And for me, 16. So, Woo! You almost got twice the amount of points that I did. So it was a big victory. So I do owe you a very nice dinner when we see each other later this year.
Yeah, at a very nice place.
In a very undisclosed location.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I'm looking forward to that. So let's dig into this into more detail. So why don't we start mentioning about the iOS 12 release?
Yeah, absolutely. So what we want to do now is we want to go through all the platforms and talk about the announcements in more detail. But what we're going to save for the next episode is more like looking into the underlying frameworks and looking into more like the spelunking results that Rambo is sure to find over the next days and weeks. So we're going to talk about the announcement, like again, from a developer's perspective, of course, and we're going to go into technical details. But on the next episode, we promise that there's going to be more look at the kind of underlying frameworks.
Yeah, especially because I've not been able to spelunk too much. I've been doing a lot of Marzipan stuff, and that takes a lot of time, especially since I messed up my system and had to reinstall at one point. So, I haven't been able to explore all of the new iOS stuff in much detail. So, yeah, wait for that.
It turns out that modifying the assembly code for the kernel actually is pretty dangerous.
Yeah, it can mess up your Mac.
who would have thought, right?
Yeah, it's very weird.
Yeah, so the one thing we are going to go into more detail about, which I think is very exciting, is that Rambo has been working with Marzipan and has been porting some of his apps and building some things with it. So stay tuned for that later this episode. All right, so iOS 12. First off, very big focus on performance, like we mentioned, and very cool to see Apple even mentioning that they are focusing a lot on making iOS 12 run really fast on older devices, which is something that we haven't really seen before. So what do you think about this?
I think it's very nice that they're doing it. They even have dedicated performance engineers. I don't know if that's new or if it's something they've always had. So yeah, I'm very happy about this. And I think many third-party developers don't realize how much this benefits us.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like whenever you have a underlying system that someone else will use, you always want that underlying system, that SDK or, you know, the platform, to take up as little space as possible, because that just leaves so much more for the user, which is us, right? So the more Apple focuses on performance and the tighter they make it and the less memory that iOS actually consumes, the more is left for us.
Yeah, you mentioned an example, I think, I don't remember when exactly, but I think it was in your last Swift by Sandel with our friend Ben Sherman.
Yeah.
You mentioned that you had some performance issues and, oh, I have a static table view with simple cells and it's stuttering. So there's nothing
exactly
I can do really here because, I don't know, rewrite it in metal or something.
Yeah, so. And I mean, we've seen people do that in the past. Kind of Lauren Brichter kind of famously wrote the first version of Letterpress like in OpenGL, right? He didn't use UIKit.
Yeah, so, and for the table view in the Tweety app, I think he used Core Animation directly instead of using standard table view. So yeah, it's bad when you want to make your app performant and you have the system behind it making everything slow to begin with. So there's nothing really you can do to improve on that. And now that the system is very fast and, might I say, swifty, you can make your apps as fast as the system will allow you. And there's also another thing, that iOS 12 is probably the goodbye OS for iPhone 5S.
Yeah.
And it's probably, probably the last version that's going to run on iPhone 5S. And iOS 11 is not running very well on that device. I have one of those and it's not running very well. So you don't want to leave those devices with a system that's not running very well, because at the same time you have developers that need to support. Usually it's a good practice to support at least the current OS minus one. So let's say in September when iOS 12 comes out, you're going to support 12 and 11. And if you had to keep supporting iOS 11 on iPhone 5S for a long time, at least one more year, that would have been complicated because it's not running very well. So it's good that we can target the new system and know that our users are going to have a good experience with the new system.
Yeah, absolutely. And it really just evens out kind of the performance target. It just evens it out a little bit more. So when we are running an app that we made on an iPhone 5S or when we're running it on the iPhone 10, sure, there's going to be a difference, especially if we do really like GPU or CPU intensive tasks. But for just like normal stuff like UI and table views and things like that, hopefully things will just work pretty much the same. And that is so much nicer when you don't have to like code these extra rules for older devices and things like that. That's just like always very annoying to have to do.
Yeah, the last thing I want to do in my apps is to have to disable certain features for older devices because they can't handle the new features in terms of performance. I want to enable features that depend on new hardware, like the TrueDepth camera system, but I don't want to limit features because the device can't run them for performance. And I think that the iOS 12 release is going to eliminate some of those cases on iPhone 5S especially.
Yeah, absolutely. So not only a great news for users of these devices, but also fantastic news for us as developers. And the cool thing is that iOS 12 also supports all the same devices as iOS 11, which I think is a lot due to the thing you just mentioned, Guy. I think that Apple, they don't want to leave these devices in such a poor state. So, you know, getting people upgraded to iOS 12, enabling them to do it, and then, you know, maybe regaining some of this, like, trust from users, because I know that a lot of people were kind of upset about iOS 11, not just, like, people who are developers and who like tech, but also just people who don't, like, people who just want their phone to work. So very, very cool, I think, that iOS 12 is such a good focus on performance and that it supports the same devices as the previous version.
Yeah, and the first beta, it corroborates that that what they said during the keynote, because it's a lot faster than iOS. At least on my iPhone 10, it's significantly faster than iOS 11.
Yeah, that's perfect. All right, next up, we want to talk a little bit more about the Do Not Disturb mode. So we mentioned that you can now say that don't disturb me while I'm sleeping. You have more fine-grained controls. And you also have a new cool mechanism for notifications where you can, at the lock screen, when you get a notification, you can fine-tune them. You can say that from now on, I want notifications from this app to just deliver them quietly to the lock screen. So lots of new kind of features, not so many APIs for us when it comes to Do Not Disturb, but lots of great features for users. And I can imagine that you also get quite a lot of notifications during the day, right?
Oh, yeah. So I have notifications disabled for lots of apps. I only leave them on for very special things and important things.
And such as messages from me, right?
Of course.
Of course.
Yeah. So yeah, I really like that they're doing this. You basically get Do Not Disturb mode for specific notifications. If you think about it, you can basically say that a specific app should always be in Do Not Disturb modes. So yeah, I really like it. And I'm looking at my stats here, and my top app in terms of notifications is Messages, and there are 321 messages in the last 7 days, I think.
Oh, okay. I thought you were going to say in the last 24 hours, and that would be quite a large number.
Yeah.
But yeah, messages is one of those. Also, usually that you don't want to disable notifications for, because in many kind of social media apps, whether you use like Twitter or Facebook or whatever, there's a lot of noise. And I don't mean that in like what people are saying is noise, but more, there's like you get a lot more things just thrown at you, whether that's like mentions or messages, or it might be just recommendations or whatever. But when you have messages with somebody, it's usually someone that you are just talking more directly with, kind of more like texting with. So yeah, I'm not super surprised by that.
I've had people come to me after I retweeted or quoted their tweet saying, "Oh my God, I can't deal with all of the notifications for likes." And I go like, "What? You have notifications enabled for likes?" If I had that enabled during the keynote, which I was live tweeting about, my phone would have died, I think. So yeah, enable notifications for stuff like that. And messages, I only get notifications for people who are really my friends. I mute all of those automated service notifications. All of that stuff is muted. So I only get notifications from people like you.
That's cool. The thing I like about this is kind of deliver quietly feature is that, like you say, usually you don't want to have notifications on for a lot of things. And this might be hard to decide when you install the app. And you might like be downloading an app from an airline, for example, and you just need it in order to get like the passbook ticket. And then they start sending you all these like, "Oh, today we have an offer, and today we have an offer again." And actually, that's like, I think, not allowed by the App Store rules to send these kind of marketing messages, but airlines do it anyway. So just, and every time I get one of those, I'm like, "Oh, I should disable notifications." And then I just go on with my day.
They send you a notification, "Buy promotional tickets to Belize." Something like that.
Yeah, exactly. It's always some destination that, like, you know,
is not
like,
relevant, okay, for you.
Yeah, this is like, this seems random, right? They just like arc for random the destination array and just send that to me. Yeah. So now that I can like quiet these directly, I feel like I'm probably going to take action more.
There's another feature that I think we can talk about now, since we're mentioning notifications, which are some new features around notifications. To begin with, apps can now send users a trial notification. So you don't have to ask the user explicit notification permissions on the first launch, like most apps tend to do. So you can just open the app normally, you register for notifications, and you can send one notification, which is not going to call the attention of the user, because it's not going to show a banner, it's not going to play a sound, it's not going to vibrate, it's not even going to show in the lock screen. it's only going to show in the list of notifications. So if the user opens the list of notifications, the trial notification will show up with a Chrome around it with some buttons that allow the user to say, hey, I would like to keep receiving notifications from this app, or no, please, I don't want any notifications from this app. And I think that that's neat. Another thing that I found really cool about notifications is that you now can have a deep link directly into the app's own notification settings. So if it's an app that shows many types of notifications and they have their own settings for notifications inside the app can now vend that deep link to the notification system. And if you decide to use the quick action to turn off notifications, they are going to offer you the option to either disable notifications entirely or go inside the app to the notification settings and only turn off the notifications you don't want.
Yeah, that's really, really great. And it's always awesome when you can link to another part of the system. That's always kind of been possible with, you know, figuring out the URL scheme and things like that. But having like a more official way to do it is always very nice. Speaking of do not disturb and, you know, notifications and things like that, like we mentioned, there's also a new screen time feature, which enables you to get more kind of in control with how you use your phone. You can get more informed with kind of, you know, what kind of behavior you have when it comes to your phone. So what is your screen time currently look, Rambo, on the iOS 12 beta?
I was going to ask you. Okay,
well, I haven't installed it yet, you know. Oh. Like we talked about last episode, I'm a little bit more skeptical than you when it comes to betas.
So here's the thing. I'm not entirely sure how it's supposed to work, because when I opened last 7 days, so today it shows nothing. It says there's no info. And for the last 7 days, it's showing an hour and 58 minutes of screen time. But yesterday, for the last 7 days, it was showing way more than that. So I think there's some sort of bug, or I don't understand how the stats work here.
Okay.
But yeah, I can say that I use my phone a lot.
Well, I'm not surprised. Have you set any app limits yet for yourself?
Not yet. I'm probably
not
going
more
to
than
try.
5 hours per day on Twitter.
Well, actually, I use it mostly from my Mac, so I think I'm fine there.
You can work around the system.
Yeah, but one aspect of this that I found really interesting is that if you set social networking limits for the category of social networking, and you open, let's say, the Facebook app, which I don't have, by the way, and I recommend you don't as well. But let's say you have the Facebook app and you set a limit for social networking apps. When you open the Facebook app, it's going to say, hey, you are over your limit for social networking. And if you try and cheat and open the Facebook website on Safari, it's going to show you the warning as well.
Oh, it gets ya.
Yeah,
that's pretty smart.
It goes after you.
Yeah, exactly. But overall, I kind of think this is a super interesting feature. And, you know, it's getting kind of obvious that we're spending more and more time on our phones. And it's always good, I think, to have information that you can act on. I'm not sure if I'm going to set like limits and things like that. But I do love getting data on these kind of things. And I do love like tracking time, not like in a kind of obsessive way where I track every single hour of the day. But I do like to kind of get an estimate of how long things usually take. And this kind of ties into that. Like if I see that I use a certain app, which will probably be like Twitter or maybe Notes, because I spend a lot of time in Notes, it's just good to have that information.
Yeah, and I watched an interview that Tim Cook gave to some TV network, which I don't remember right now, but he mentioned that what they want to do with this is allow the user to decide if they need to set a limit for themselves and give the user the power to decide if they are spending too much time with apps and not like forcibly limit your time with apps.
Yeah, that's really good, I think. And again, it's like providing the data and enabling you to act on it. I think that's the right move, and not trying to be too policing, but rather just like provide the information. I think that's always very, very nice.
They could add an activity ring to Apple Watch, which is off screen time or something, so you it measures how much time you spent away from any screens, and so for that to work, they would have to integrate this with the Mac as well.
Well, I'll just go to my PlayStation then instead.
Ooh.
All right. Next up, we have Memoji, which we mentioned also was really cool during our after show where you were using that. That's like one of the features that I really can't wait to use. I'm sure it's going to be really exciting. But I also think it's going to be like an emoji. I'm going to use it once just because it's cool and then never again. Have you used Memoji again?
Yeah, I feel a little bit differently about Memoji than Animoji, because first of all, they are way more expressive. I'm not sure if that's a perception because they are human-like, or if it's the models are more detailed, but they are very expressive and more expressive than Animoji. And Animoji, they are very specific, so you have the cats and the fox and stuff like that, and you can't use those in every situation. So I have been using Memoji more than I thought I would. Sometimes someone sends me something and I make a little face and drag a sticker of my face, so as a Memoji, so rolling my eyes or screaming or laughing or sad or something. And it's really funny, and it's more personal than Animoji.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, it looks like a really cool feature. And I also love that they've now integrated both Memoji and Animoji in FaceTime and in the messages camera. Like you mentioned, you can, you know, take a picture of yourself and turn that into a sticker. And especially with the new FaceTime feature where you can finally do group calling with up to 32 people, which is really, really impressive. It's like jumping from 2 people to 32. That's a quite big jump. So I feel like having an emoji there might also be really cool. Like if you want to, if you're in a meeting, if you use FaceTime for meetings now and you just want to, you know, have a little fun, you could always put on a unicorn face.
Yeah. And there's also the aspect of building your character, which people underestimate how much people like doing that. You see, I have an app.
There's
Chibi
an app
Studio.
For that.
Yeah, and the app is all based around you creating your characters, and that is something that people really, really like from the reviews we get of people really excited about and telling us about how much time they spend just creating random characters in the app. Maybe it's a candidate for screen time protection there. people really, really, really like spending time creating characters and choosing the eyes and the beard and the face and hair and stuff. So I think that's an aspect of Memoji that's going to get people busy.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so I'm a huge gamer. I play a lot of video games. And one of my favorite games over the last couple of years is a game called Skyrim. And in Skyrim, it's like a role-playing game. You create your own character in the beginning. And my girlfriend was also kind of interested in this. So she wanted to try the game out. And so the first thing you do is you create your character. And she spent around like 2 hours creating her character. And then she played like 5 minutes. And then she was like, oh, no, I'm done. So, yeah. And I think this is something that can happen to a lot of people. Where,
yeah, definitely.
You know, customizing and doing this stuff. And we can see it with games. We can see it with, you know, all these sticker packs and all these things like customizing, making it your own. It's the creative process there. It's a lot of fun for a lot of people. And I like doing that, too.
Yeah, especially since Animoji recordings are limited to 30 seconds, so you're definitely going to spend more time building the character than using it.
Yeah, absolutely. ARKit, ARKit 2.0, really, really cool, I think. Like you mentioned earlier, is that we still haven't seen like the big, big like thing that AR has the potential to be, I think, in terms of hardware and in terms of kind of what you can do with it. But I do love that Apple, they seem to be very, very focused on building like a super thorough, robust platform for AR and taking it that way instead of kind of building it from the ground up. And with the shared AR experiences now, where you can have multiple people in the same AR session and you can also persist them for later, I think that's super interesting. So what do you think?
Yeah, I feel like they are building up to the Apple Glasses project and the ROS project that we've heard about. And I think they are trying to make the development market ready for when they release that product so they can go on stage and say, and we have such and such million developers ready for this platform. So because I really don't see the value in using AR with handheld devices like we do today. It's amazing, it's impressive, it's fun depending on what you're doing, but I don't see how it's better than just using an app. For instance, we have someone made an example this weekend. I saw the video where they point the camera at a loyalty card, and it shows how many points they have in the loyalty card or something. That's really cool, but like if I have to pick up my phone, I'd prefer to just open the app for the loyalty card and just see the
just show me the data.
Yeah, just show me. Yeah. If I had my glasses, though, that would make a huge difference because then it's just a matter of looking at the thing.
Yeah, and then we're not really talking about apps so much anymore. We're more talking about like extensions to the system, right? And there's a loyalty card extension that can automatically detect that through the glasses or something like that.
Yeah, and then it becomes better than using your phone. But right now it's not better because it's worse because I have to pick up my phone and point the camera and it has to detect the world and the card has to be aligned so it captures correctly. So yeah, it's not better than just using an app for that. So yeah, if you have the glasses, it makes a huge difference.
Yeah, I think that there's a couple of different parts to this puzzle. Like, first of all, I think that Apple has really learned their lesson with both the Watch and Apple TV, that just because they have a new app store doesn't mean that there will be this new gold rush. They were always saying this when they launched a new app store. Do you remember that? Or it's like the iPad launch, and it was like, there's going to be a new gold rush. They always use this term.
Yeah, and I think it only really happened with the iPhone and maybe a little bit with the original iPad.
Yeah, the Mac App Store maybe a little bit as well, but not that in the same capacity.
It went
right?
down from that. It started with the iPhone. It was a huge gold rush, which lasted for years. And then the iPad was okay. The Mac App Store, meh. And the tvOS and watchOS and iMessage, nothing.
Right. And I think they learned a lot from that, that just because they launch a new app store doesn't mean that there will be thousands of apps, 2 days later. And with ARKit, it feels like if they were to launch something like glasses or something like that, a hologram projector, they've now realized that, you know what, let's try to build the developer platform first, like you mentioned, and let's have like a huge suite of AR apps that will just work. I mean, maybe you'll have to port it a little bit, but if it's using ARKit, it will work because it will just use the new hardware. And that is really, really powerful. So I think that's an important part of this puzzle. And the second part is that I feel that it's still very, very young. Like it came out for users not even a year ago. So I feel like we haven't really nailed this yet. And it's a completely new way of building interfaces, of interacting with an app. And I feel like the app ideas and the things you can do with it, we haven't really seen like the killer app yet. And I think that's not something that, it doesn't say too much about the technology itself, but rather it's just a natural progression that when technology is brand new, it always takes quite a while before someone can really nail it, right?
Yeah, I agree with you that the new is an aspect, but I really don't believe, and I really, really don't believe that we are going to see a killer app for AR which runs on a phone or an iPad. I really don't think that's going to happen. I think the killer app for AR is coming with the glasses only, because I really can't see it happening with the phone. If I have to touch the screen of my phone to use an interface, I prefer to use a regular interface. I don't see any value in using a 3D interface in the real world.
I think with the advancements they've made this year with object detection, I think that's a big step in the right direction. Because if you want to do object detection, you already have to use the camera. And if you're already using the camera, you can use AR to overlay on top of it to provide you with that information straight away.
Yeah, just to be clear, I'm not talking about like camera apps to do effects and stuff. That's all awesome. And Memoji is an example of AR. So yeah. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about apps that you use in a 3D interface.
Right. So like the games and things that they have been demoing. Like, yeah.
Yeah.
Like we mentioned earlier, I think we should do like a more deep dive episode on AR because there's so much to discuss here. But for now, let's move on. This is all really, really exciting. And I think we're going to see more things about AR later.
I think we can say I'm an AR skeptic.
And you can say that I'm an AR enthusiast. All right, next up is Siri Shortcuts.
Woo!
And yeah, that deserves a woo. That is so cool. And I love the fact that not only is it, you know, you can automate things. They have an automation app called Shortcuts, which is looks like workflow, which is great. But they also have deep integration for developers, which is very unusual for like a 1.0 from Apple to see this level of developer connectivity. What do you think?
Yeah, I really think they did a great job with the Shortcuts thing. And we should talk about the Shortcuts app because it's not available in the App Store yet. And from what we can see and by analyzing the slides from the keynote and other content, it's basically workflow that they are renaming to Shortcuts. And it's going to have everything workflow has, including all of the scripting capabilities, but it's going to have all of this deep integration with the system and with Siri.
Yeah, and that's perfect. One thing that I really love about this is that when Siri first came out, there was a really big focus on Siri, like being able to understand these complex sentences. Like you're asking, do I need an umbrella today? Or will it be hot today? And Siri automatically interprets that as, you know, you want the weather. And while those things are cool, like they provide for a great demo, in kind of day-to-day life, I always just ask Siri, what's the weather? Like always the same thing. And I don't know about other people, but from what I've seen and heard, the people who do use Siri, which is, you know, not everybody, but most people, they treat it kind of like as a voice command line. And this is exactly that. This is literally, you can assign voice commands to an action, which I think is much, much nicer because it eliminates so many possibilities of Siri not understanding you.
Yeah, there are two classes of integration which apps can adopt for Siri Shortcuts. We can mention the user activity based one, and there's also the intent based one. So if you're in an app that has specific content that you are using user activity to maybe adopt handoff and deep linking and other stuff, you can just set one little flag in the user activity and it becomes eligible for Shortcuts. And the cool thing about it is that the system learns about what the user is doing in your app based on this user activity system. And it's something that's been used by Apple's own apps for quite a while now, and now they're making it available for third parties. So you can be browsing a specific content within an app, and if you, let's say, browse the same content every Tuesday at 9 p.m., Siri is going to learn that and is going to start suggesting that deep link for you, even in the lock screen, if it's really confident. So that's one of the integration things that can be done. And the second one is custom intents, which is really nice.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's another one of those things that people were speculating that that's probably never going to happen. Because, you know, Apple, for now, for example, you can basically build intents for music playback or for podcast playback. And a lot of people were speculating that, no, you know, Apple, they want to protect Apple Music. That's the only thing that's going to be integrated into Siri. So I'm really, really excited to see this. And again, it just opens up so many doors. And I feel like the strategy for Siri has fundamentally shifted, it seems like, instead of being this like, let's integrate everything just deeply into the system. Everything from like sports scores to weather to everything. Let's instead open it up. Let's make it a little bit more simple, and let's enable people to both like extend it as users to assign shortcuts, but also as developers to, you know, create these more simple intents, which I think, you know, really limits the grammar and limits the complexity of using Siri.
You mentioned the strategy for Siri. Let me tell you about my strategy for streamlined food ordering, which I've been thinking about for quite a while. And I've given this example many times before, which I ordered the same pizza from the same place pretty much every Friday night. So I would really, really like to be able to ask my HomePod to just order that, and maybe just do the Apple Pay thing on my phone, and that's it. So I'm going to be giving a talk on Siri shortcuts next month, and it's going to be at a conference that I know there's probably going to be at least one or two developers from the app I use to order my pizza. You see what I'm doing there?
Yeah, nice.
So I'm trying to evangelize Siri shortcuts.
That's awesome. But you know what you can actually just do? You can just make a deal with this pizzeria. You can just like give them prepay for 2 months of pizza. And they will just send you a pizza every Friday, like a subscription service.
Oh, no, please. Not another subscription.
All right, that's awesome. Let's make Siri shortcuts something we can dive a little bit more deeper into on upcoming episodes as well, because I still want to play around with it. You're going to give this talk, so I'm sure you're going to learn a bunch of things about Siri as well and about these new shortcuts. But on the kind of surface level, it looks really, really exciting. All right, what we really want to get to now actually is macOS, because this is, I think, what we both are the most excited about. So we're just going to go through watchOS and tvOS a bit more quickly, even though there were some really cool announcements there as well. So for developers, one of the most significant changes to watchOS is that we can now play audio in the background on the watch.
Yet another finally.
Yeah, exactly. Third-party apps can now use proper background audio APIs. So hopefully we're going to see Overcast on the watch and other podcast players and maybe some music streaming services, who knows?
Yeah, I think Marco pretty much confirmed that he's going to work with this new API, so let's hope that we get Overcast. And I'm actually going to I think he has a Slack group for the Overcast users, and I'm going to offer to be a beta tester.
Nice, that's perfect. Another thing that is interesting, I feel, is the shortcuts that we just talked about, that it's also on the watch, and it's featured quite prominently on the Siri watch face.
Yeah.
And I think that's pretty interesting, because it seems like they are putting more and more focus on the actual Siri watch face. It might be something, I feel, where maybe eventually that kind of functionality will be available on more watch faces. Or what do you think?
Yeah, they could do that. I also think that maybe in a future device, future iPhone that has always-on display in the lock screen, it could maybe display those Siri complications, let's call them that, on iPhone. And a cool thing about this Siri watch face integration is that the app doesn't even need a watch app to integrate with that. So if it's an app from your phone, it can vend those user activities and intents, and it's going to show up there as well.
Yeah, and just like we talked about with the potential AR glasses from Apple, that it might not make sense for like an app metaphor in that kind of context. I also feel like the app metaphor is a bit misplaced on the watch, because after all, what you just want most of the time is just like one screen you can just glance at and you can just see all your information. You don't want to install apps and fiddle around with them. And I feel like Apple is moving in this direction a lot, where it's more like, let's just pull things from the iPhone apps and display them, you know, directly there on the watch face.
The app I use the most on my watch is Carrot Weather, because it's the main complication. I use the modular watch face, and I just looked at my wrist, but I'm not wearing my Apple Watch. I use the modular watch face, and I use the Carrot Weather complication as the main big complication in the middle, and every now and then, I actually launch the app because I want to see what Carrot has to say about the weather, which is usually something very funny. So I use the app a lot, and it is a watch app, but I don't go to the Honeycomb view and tap the app icon to launch it.
Exactly. And that is where I feel like there is really no reason, like architecturally, why that couldn't just be an extension, right? An extension that just installs directly on your phone. You can add it as a complication. You can have it in the Siri feed and all these kind of things. Because an app feels like more of these things like you launch it, it runs, then it terminates. It has this more like life cycle where it starts where you start using it and it ends where you stop using it. And it feels like more like watch things are always there, like your Carrot Weather complication, and it just takes on other shapes and forms as you start interacting with it.
Yeah, I'm going to be happy with the app architecture on all Apple's platforms when they can eliminate the options dictionary from application did finish launching, which is like, well, we're going to launch your app and you should look into this dictionary because there are hundreds of keys that can be here that maybe your app is launching in the background. Maybe it's launching because of a location refresh. Maybe it's launching because of an audio thing. And I really feel like all of that stuff should be separate targets and separate executables that run independently of your app.
Yeah, absolutely. And the whole system becomes so much more modular, and you could also end up with a lot of battery life savings, because if you only want to like handle a rich notification, and that is an extension, right now the system has to fire up the app, it has to fire up the extension, it has to, like, the app runs, the app delegate and all this kind of things, which probably like fires up the database and even creates the main UI, even though it's not even going to be displayed.
And those network requests probably.
Yeah, all those things, right? So I feel like if we could have a more kind of encouragement from this in the system to build apps as like more these microservices that can each be invoked separately, or they can be composed together or whatever, that will both lead us to like a nicer architecture, but also it could enable so many cool features and battery life savings.
Yeah, and I really feel like they are moving towards that slowly. I'd like it to be faster, but they are moving into that slowly. With the Siri intents thing, you can provide an UI that's going to show up in Siri, and that's a completely separate target that defines the UI. And even the UI target is separate from your extension target that actually handles the commands and stuff. So yeah, I think they are moving towards something more like that. I'm just impatient.
Yeah, me too. All right, for tvOS, there wasn't a whole lot of new things for developers. One of the main features was that now you can see where one of these, you know, aerial screenshots, actually where it's from, which I myself, I don't know if you've done this as well, but I've so many times have just searched for Apple TV screensaver, where is it from?
And conversation as well. Sometimes you have a guest and the screensaver is showing up and, oh, where is that? And yeah, I have asked that question many times. The thing is, that's not working for me, at least.
Oh, okay. All right. Maybe it's not there yet.
Isn't it like you just touch the touchpad and it should show up, right? But it's not showing for me, so I don't know what's going on there. Maybe not right, in beta one.
Maybe they haven't figured out where all of them are from yet.
Yeah. They're still Googling.
Exactly. One thing that kind of flew a little bit under the radar, it wasn't mentioned in the keynote, of course, because it's a pure developer feature, but it seems like Apple has taken some of the kind of core UI components from tvOS that they use in their own apps and kind of bundle them up into a TV UI kit. So there's now a TV UI kit framework that contains like commonly used UI elements. And I guess the idea here is that you shouldn't necessarily need to build the UI using these XML formats in order to use the standard controls, and instead kind of just being able to instantiate them programmatically, which I think is pretty cool.
Yeah, so we've had two options when we are making tvOS apps. One of them is to make a UI kit app, which is pretty similar to an iPhone app, but it has the UI adapted to the TV screen. And another one is to use TVML, which is a variant of XML that uses XML and some JavaScript as well to build your interface. And it's kind of like React Native, in the sense that you define the interface as an XML and with some JavaScript, and it becomes real native UI. So you get the native UI benefits, even though you're using a markup language. And now what they're doing is they are allowing you to write native apps, but using the components you would define with this XML stuff. So yeah, I think that that's a good move.
Yeah, it's really cool. And another improvement that kind of flew under the radar is that the Focus Engine is now supporting more kinds of contexts. So the Focus Engine is the underlying engine that kind of helps you navigate through UIs on tvOS. Like one element can have focus, and then you can move to different elements. And that was currently tied to kind of UIKit, but now you can also use it in like Apple's game frameworks like SpriteKit, SceneKit. And I also want to investigate whether I could actually add support for it in Imagine Engine, which is my game engine that I wrote. Because I do like the Focus Engine. I think that it's a really cool system.
Yeah, you mentioned to me at one point that you wanted to make a agnostic controlling API for Imagine Engine, right?
Yeah, exactly. Like just abstract away whether you're using a remote or you're using just your touch or you're using a keyboard, so that when you're coding your game, you can just say like when this interaction happens, whether it's like, you know, a click or a drag or something like that, you can just run a closure. And this is kind of how the API already looks, but it would be super cool to also integrate Focus Engine under the hood for that.
Yeah, I think we abstract away the specifics of so many things already, such as at least on macOS, which we're going to talk about in a bit, colors. We tend to use semantic names for colors and stuff. So I really feel like we should move away from specific actions like click and tap and choose some generic term like activate or something. Because it doesn't really matter what action was taken to do the activation. What matters is that the UI component was activated. And that's some nerdy programmer stuff right there for you.
Yeah, absolutely. And it depends. Like sometimes you need to, of course, have more fine-grained control. But for a lot of the majority use case, you can actually, yeah, have a more high-level way of expressing, especially user interactions. So yeah, it's really cool, and it's interesting to see like the Focus Engine being more widely used, because I think it's a really interesting technology.
It's not a Stack Trace episode until we mention the word abstraction.
Exactly. Yeah, moving up and down the Stack Trace, right? That's what we're all about. So now the time has finally come. Let's talk about Mac OS Mojave. And it's very cool that Apple saved the Mac for last, which I think is kind of telling, because the Mac this year was a big focus, and it got a lot of cool new updates. So I am very, very happy about that.
Oh yeah, I'm very, very happy. And when they showed the outline for the keynote at the beginning, and I noticed that macOS was the last one, I was very excited, because they always leave the best for last. And they usually leave iOS as the last item, because it's usually the one that has more stuff and is more important. But this year it was macOS.
Yeah, they usually tend to like go through the Mac super quickly, and then tvOS super quickly. Watch, they spend like a little bit more time, and then let's talk about iOS. That's why we're all here, right? But this time it was different, and I really like that. So first of all, we got dark mode, and you know, like we mentioned in the beginning, you were very, very excited about it. I am also really excited about it. I always run as many apps as I can in dark mode. And now having like a system-wide setting for it, I think will be fantastic.
Yeah, I'm very happy. And I have Mojave installed in an external SSD here for testing, which is a good thing because I messed up the installation already once. So it's good that I have, I only have my own one Mac, so I can't install it as a main OS on any machine. So I have it externally and I'm definitely running it in dark mode most of the time.
The changes that you noticed in WebKit that a website can also detect dark mode, is that present in the final release, or it's not a final release, but is that present in the current beta of Mojave? Have you checked that?
Not yet, from what I've seen. The code I noticed in WebKit, it suggests that websites are going to be able to opt in to dark mode and maybe even detect if the current machine is in dark mode. But I really don't expect anyone to adopt that. Maybe you.
Yeah, of course.
Maybe Apple themselves with their website, but I really don't expect it to get wide adoption. So I think websites that are used a lot by Mac users are probably going to get. People are going to start complaining and they maybe decide to implement it, but I really don't expect this to get wide adoption in the web.
Yeah, it really depends on how they implement it. If it's just like they set a CSS class on the HTML element or something like that, or there's some new WebKit specific attribute that you can check for.
It was something in the media queries from what I've seen.
Okay, right. So it's like when you are doing the screen size media queries or something, you can query for dark mode as well.
Yeah, something like that.
Okay. Yeah, it could work. I think it all depends on how difficult it can be to implement and also whether or not the site already supports some kind of theming. Like you mentioned that I will probably implement it, and I, of course, will. And that's also because my website currently already supports themes. So you can already run Swift by Sandel in the light theme or dark theme or even a black theme for the iPhone X. Definitely I would support
and
that.
It's cool that you can have, if you have like a form, the forms use the native system controls. So if you have a form, you can have the form in your dark mode using the system controls in dark mode. So that's going to look really nice if you adopt it on a website.
All right. So there was a bunch of new features in macOS, you know, Finder improvements, desktop stacks, the new way to take screenshots. But I think what we all really want to talk about is more about this Marzipan. So Rambo, tell us about your recent adventures since you got your hands on this. You've been patching the kernel in order to be able to load this framework. You've been porting the 9to5 Mac app and the Shibi Studio app to run on the Mac. Tell us about your adventures with Marzipan.
Yeah, so first of all, the name is Marzipan. So we confirmed that I managed to find lots of references to Marzipan in there. So Mark Gurman was right when he mentioned the Marzipan project. So yeah, this at least at one point, this was called Marzipan, and there are some references to that in the code. So yeah, it's Marzipan. So it's really interesting. You know, when you develop for Apple's platforms, you have those defines. Platform embedded, platform iOS, platform tvOS. There's a new platform now, and the name of the platform is Platform iOS Mac, which is kind of funny.
The best platform.
Yeah, so the name of this whole thing, which is not Marzipan externally, is iOS Mac. So and the issue with you making your own Marzipan apps at the moment is that, well, first of all, there are no tools for it because it's an Apple internal thing at the moment.
You can't go new project in Xcode, Marzipan. Yeah. Use the Marzipan template, please.
Actually, I should probably make a template for that because you can make your own Xcode templates.
Yeah, totally.
So if anyone hasn't made one already. So yeah, you can... there are no tools for it. And also they gated the ability to run these apps using an entitlement. So entitlements are special signatures that Apple can provide for apps that enable specific features such as iCloud and Siri and other things, Apple Pay. Those are all entitlements that an app must request, and Apple is going to sign the app with those entitlements. And Apple has their own private entitlements that only Apple can have. And one of them is, I think it's com.apple.private.iosmac. So only apps which possess that entitlement can run in this marzipan mode. So we obviously can't get that entitlement from Apple because it's private and they are not giving it to anyone yet. So what you have to do is you have to basically modify your system so it's going to allow apps that have an invalid code signature to run, which is extremely dangerous, and you shouldn't try this at home. Don't try this at home, kids. So initially I was being more aggressive with my method and patching the kernel and opening the kernel in a hex editor and invalidating the pre-linked kernel cache and modifying kernel extensions and stuff. But it turns out you can only set a flag in the kernel boot arguments, assuming you have system integrity protection disabled, which is AMFI get out of my way. That's the name.
I love these like private flags. They always have these really funny names.
Yeah, you know? There's also like one which is ICANN has debugger, which is really nice. Funny. So yeah, so basically you have to disable system integrity protection, which is already dangerous, and then you have to set this boot argument, which basically tells the system that, hey, whatever, run anything, no matter how bad the code signature is. So yeah, so that's what you have to do. And then, of course, you have to extract headers from frameworks and extract module definitions from binaries and create your own mock SDK and stuff. So yeah, it's very complicated, but it's less complicated than I thought it would be. It wasn't that hard because I'm not very familiar with the intricacies of how the kernel validates code signatures and stuff. I've read something about that, but it's not something I mess with very frequently.
It's not like in your day-to-day job as an iOS developer. It's like, yeah, hey, let's just patch the kernel for this bug. It's not a problem.
Yeah, and it's not like my regular spelunking where I'm looking at frameworks and apps and stuff. It's a very different type of thing. Involves deep stuff within the system. So yeah, I had to learn some things, and yeah, it was fun. And do you want to ask me any questions about it?
Yeah, like the thing I'm mostly interested in is like how much of UIKit is actually available. Like, do you have all of UIKit at your disposal, or when you started running Shibi Studio, did you have to like comment out some commands and some code that wasn't yet available in Marzipan?
Actually, from what I've seen, UIKit itself is pretty much all there.
With core animation, with all these things, I mean, of course, core animation is already there on the Mac, but it kind of behaves the same way, even though it's used in this new way.
Yeah, so Chibi Studio is very heavily based on core animation. Basically, when you're editing your character, you're building a core animation layer tree, and it worked flawlessly right away. I had to change. There was one thing in the canvas view, so the view that is where you edit your character. I had implemented selection in touches began, so there's this method, touches began, mm-hmm. and it, for some reason it wasn't working when I clicked a layer in the canvas. So the only thing I had to do was to move that to a tap gesture recognizer, and it worked right away. So,
interesting.
Little minor difference there. And then all I did was disable third-party code, of course. So I had two frameworks the app was using, the Google AdMob framework, which we use to give rewards to users, and the IG ListKit framework as well. So I didn't want to bother with those. So of course I just removed anything that had to do with them from the app. And right. Also I flattened the app. So it has a couple of frameworks, internal frameworks, and I flattened those to basically have all the code in the one binary because it makes things easier, not because it's necessary. But yeah, it was it. Basically, in a little over 2 hours, most of which was spent dealing with issues of not having an SDK. yeah. I had my app, my UIKit app working on the Mac, and it runs very well.
That's awesome. And the way you kind of build it, you have set these things up in Xcode, like with custom build steps or something to link against these mock SDKs and things you've set up so that you can just like write code in Xcode just like you would for your iOS app and just run it as a Mac app?
Yeah, it works surprisingly well. So you change the... Basically, you select the SDK as the iOS SDK. So you're using the iOS SDK, but you change the framework search paths to use the /system/iOS support based one, which is where the UIKit for Mac is stored.
Oh, and right, yeah.
So there's a whole iOS subsystem installed on your Mac, which runs from that location. So you basically point the linker to that, and you can build your app in Xcode like any other app, and you can even debug it. It's not very reliable to debug. It crashes the Windows server sometimes. So yeah, the developer experience, even without having an SDK, is pretty good.
Awesome. That's it's really, really cool. So I also am really curious, like, because right now Apple already has a UIKit implementation for the simulator, which has a little bit of a different purpose, right? Because there you're actually just simulating using an iOS device. While here you want to render the UI, but you still want it to behave like a Mac app. So do you think there's like any overlap in these two implementations? Do they share some of the underlying technologies or are they completely separate?
I'm not sure how much is shared between the simulator and the UIKit system. Basically, the way it works is there's a system daemon that spawns on demand that's called UIKit system. And it's basically all rendered remotely through inter-process communication. So you have an app that's a window, but the contents of the window are rendered in a separate process from the one that owns the window, which is kind of interesting. But yeah, I can say it's very similar to the UIKit simulator framework because the UIKit simulator framework is basically UIKit that runs on your iPhone, but built for x86-64. So there are some differences, but this UIKit for Mac framework, it also includes some new classes, which are specially designed for the Mac for handling things such as translucent sidebars, and toolbars in Windows and handling Mac menus and stuff. So like for Chibi Studio, I added a menu for creating a new chibi. So you can press Command N and it opens the new chibi view. And I disabled navigation bars in the app and moved the stuff that was in the navigation bars to the toolbar in the window, in the Mac window. So it looks more Mac-like.
Nice.
But they are still iOS apps. So they still show some iOS app behavior, which they might decide to change to be more Mac-like, or maybe not. Maybe they'll leave it like that. Who knows? It's the first beta.
Yeah, it all depends on kind of where Apple is going with the Mac in general, I think. Because if they are planning to change the design a little bit so that with navigation bars and all these kind of more iOS UI paradigms. If the Mac, like the app kit, will get some of those as well, then, you know, probably they will still be there. But it seems like in the current iteration, there is no kind of smart translation going on in terms of the UI. Like it will just render what you've put in there. So if you don't explicitly say that you want like a Mac a toolbar, you know, Mac buttons in the toolbar and things like that, you just get the normal iOS navigation bar, right?
Yeah, precisely. The only thing you get for free right now, from what I've seen, is if the main view of your app is a tab bar controller, the tab bar disappears and it becomes a segmented control in the window toolbar at the top.
Ooh, that's very nice.
Yeah, so that's so tab-based apps are going to look very, very nice. And I even made some mock-ups of Netflix and YouTube, and those are probably going to be in the article I'm writing about this.
Oh, that's awesome. So look forward to that on 9to5 Mac soon. Yeah. All right, so I think that's all we have time for this episode. We, of course, are going to dig so much more into these things on upcoming episodes. And right now, we do a new episode every 2 weeks. But we would really love to start doing this show every single week. But in order to be able to dedicate that extra time that it takes to record and edit and everything about the show, we need your support. And that's why we started our Patreon. And our Patreon is currently at about 25% to getting weekly shows. So if you like the show and you would love to see us do it more often, consider just chipping in a few bucks. It doesn't have to be much, but a lot of it really, really helps. So thank you so much to everyone who has already become a Patreon of the show. And we're looking forward to getting even more people involved and becoming part of this new community that we're building. And hopefully we'll be able to do the show weekly pretty soon. Or what do you think, Rambo?
Yeah, and I really loved interacting with our patrons during the after show. So I'm looking forward for the next one.
Yeah, absolutely. So until we talk to you next time, you can find us on Twitter. I am at John Sundell. Rambo is at _inside. We also have an account for Stacktrace at StacktracePod, where you can see us post when we're going to record a new episode or when a new episode comes out. And you can find the show notes for this podcast on our website, stacktracepodcast.fm. But that's about it. So thank you so much for listening, everybody. And say goodbye, Mr. Rambo.
Goodbye.